Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, all my dear friends. This is your spokesman with the plan, Clarence Cloverleaf, welcoming you to Cloverleaf Radio on the JIA Network. You can listen to our shows on close to 20 different streaming platforms, including Anchor, iHeartRadio, Podbean, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Radio Public, and YouTube, to name a few. I've helped compile a list of our best guests since 2008, and those interviews have been scattered about the cloud, as they say. Something I thought we only received rain from. Go figure. So, go find yourself a good one, and you can listen 24/7, 365, to guests from all genres of entertainment. You never know who could show up. Check out www.jianetwork.com. And now, on to the main event with your host, the host with the most, Jimmy Falcon. And, well, quite frankly, anyone as his guest.
Hey, this is actress Brianna Denski. You may know me best as playing June in the film Wonder Park. And you're listening to Cloverleaf Radio, hosted by the host with the most, Jimmy Falcon.
Alrighty, we are back for another exciting edition of Cloverleaf Radio. I'm the host with the most, Jimmy Falcon, and it is an absolute honor to welcome back today retired intelligence detective, documentarian, podcast host, author. You've just done it all. You have so many things that you've done, I can't even name all of them. But Gary Jenkins is joining us.
Well, thank you, Jimmy. It's great to be back. We haven't talked for a while. Been a couple of years, I think. I've done a few things since then.
Yeah, what's new with you? How's things been? What have you been working on?
Well, I guess one thing you didn't mention, and I think that I cover all the bases digitally. Because that's where everything is going, you know, everything's digital now. And I created the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And so that's out there in the Apple Store. And you can take a mob tour of Kansas City, no matter where you are. I put in pictures and maps and text and, you know, kind of explain why this location is important. Have some pictures, either old pictures or maybe a new picture of it. Kind of depend on the location and what's important and why that's important, and go all around the city. And I covered the mob from the 30s all the way up to the 90s. There's not much to do with the mob today, so I didn't do that. And then I don't want to get in trouble with a few that are around here by putting pictures of their joints in there and saying those are mob joints. I just soon leave that alone. I'm not a policeman anymore.
Yeah, man, going back to the 30s, Lucky Luciano and Al Capone and Elliot Ness coming in and cracking down on Capone, there was a lot going on. I think the average person might not realize that Kansas City, Missouri does have some pretty strong mob ties.
Oh, my God. This was a mob city. They were tied in with the political organization that owned the city and the county government, and just like the outfit did in Chicago. Well, the Kansas City outfit or Kansas City crime family, they pretty much owned all the important politicians and had a lot of judges and everything in their pocket. They could get we had a guy that got caught in the act of doing a hit, and actually even by the sheriff of Jackson County. It's 1934, I think. And he ended up getting convicted for illegal possession of a weapon because it was stolen from a National Guard armory. But the sheriff stumbled onto him shooting this guy and killed him. So that's how well connected they were. Now, it's changed a lot since then. It's not like that anymore now, of course. But so we did a film, a mafia film festival here, myself and another guy. He has a movie that goes all the way back to the turn of the century and called Black Hand Straw Man. And so last year we thought it'd be a good idea to show his movie and my movie. And then we got a retired FBI agent who's written a book, Mobsters in Our Midst, a man named Bill Owsley. And he said he'd come over. And so we show one of his movie, and then we do a kind of a panel discussion and take questions. And then we show my movie. And we're just getting ready to do that again this November, the 15th, 16th, and 17th. We sold out last year, man. I don't know. I hope we can do as well this year, and we're going to do the same thing. And I've created I've filmed and and then editing almost to the end of my final editing process right now, another documentary about a mob war in Kansas City in the 1970s.
Well, that is wonderful, and if memory serves me correct, you also have an app titled Western Underground Railroad.
You know, I had to. The app, I have a movie called Freedom Seekers, Stories from Western Underground Railroad. The app, I let it go. I have to pay something each month to keep it up, and I was not selling any of them at all, so I had I let that go. But I do have the movie out there. I went out and, like I said, I like to keep on everything up on everything that's digital. So I went out in this area close to Kansas City, within 50 miles or so of Kansas City, and geocached a whole bunch of sites and put them up and put some text in there to explain why that particular Underground Railroad site was important. So, you know, I've never geocached the sites in Kansas City. I never got around to the mob sites in Kansas City. That might be something that's kind of fun to do someday.
Yeah, geocaching is a lot of fun. I've done it. They have it out here here in Illinois, out in the country by where I'm at. There's some spots, and I did it a couple times. So it's neat little fun if you're bored, just to go out driving and try to find these spots. And with the historicalness of the spots you're involved with, that's an even better deal.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it is you can go out and just put this little – hide this little container and put some little knickknack in it, and then people like to go out and find those. But when they get there, then they click on something, and you could put information why that site's important. So it's just like the app, you know, you got it right there on your phone, and you can go to the site and then go somewhere and find out why that's important and see, you know, maybe some old historical things. I have links to my mob app. I even have links to some videos that from my movie and from Terrence's movie. He did that when we go back into the 30s or something, like the Union Station. Why I can link in a clip from his movie on my mob tour app, and you can do the same thing on the geocaching functions.
Wow. Well, that is very awesome. I think it's cool how you're taking all this history and making it available in an app, a thing that a lot of young people are, you know, have on their phones. I got a few on mine, and of course the younger kids sure have a lot more. And I think the historicalness that yours gives back, like I mentioned, is very awesome and great for helping the kids learn about history.
Yeah, I think it is too, because that's how they learn. I once was given a talk on the mob in Kansas City, and it was about 150 or 200 lawyers, and as I mentioned this app, I sent something out in the crowd. Of course, you know, I'm a pretty decent speaker. I'm watching my audience, and I noticed that a whole lot of phones came up, and they just started, you know, clicking on it because they were downloading the app. And as I looked around, it was all the like 20 to the young lawyers, the 25 to the 35-year-old crowd. The older guys were not, and women were not, didn't have their phones up clicking on things, but all the younger people were downloading that app immediately. So that's, you know, you just have to keep up with the younger generation, you know, in regards to that digital thing and making things more interactive digitally and interactive with the internet, with online things. I wrote the book, Leaving Vegas, How FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination of Las Vegas Casinos. And really, basically, it still tells the same story that my movie tells. It's kind of a companion book to my documentary, Gangland Wire. I start out telling about this dispute we had over some liquor licenses and some bar owners trying to move into another area that was a local guy who was he was a son of a mob guy, but he was straight, and he kept fighting and kept ratting out to the city liquor control these mob guys, and they'd try to come in and get a liquor license to move in this new area that was a real family friendly area, because he knew they'd spoil it. And they ended up getting his father killed, and he had to go on the lam, and they were trying to kill him, and he ended up going to witness protection. But out of that, when they knew, the FBI knew that there was some plans being made to kill this guy and to kill a couple other guys connected to him in a particular tavern over here, where they got a hidden microphone and inserted it in there. And then when they started listening, all they heard was information about Las Vegas and not directly money talk about skimming from Las Vegas, but about all these connections they had in Las Vegas and about, you know, how much some casino was making every month and who's in on that and all that kind of stuff. And so that's when it took the twist and went out to Las Vegas, and they started running wires here in Kansas City and in Vegas and Chicago and Cleveland and Milwaukee, because by the end, you know, out of that investigation, and this is what Gangland Wire, the movie, my documentary talks about, and then this book, I just tell this in written form, tell that story and how that all went down. And in the when I made this movie, I had to go to the U.S. Attorney's office and talk to them and get them on board, and I had to file a motion with the federal court here in western part of Missouri in Kansas City, and asked them to give me an order to order the FBI to release all the audio that would been put in at trial as evidence in the trials for the skimming from Las Vegas casinos. And, you know, those trials were huge in for the mob and throughout the whole United States, but particularly in the Midwest, because they charged and convicted the heads of the crime family here in Kansas City, Carl and Nick Savella, the two brothers that basically ran it, and their underboss, Duffy DeLuna, and a couple of their underlings. They convicted, the government convicted Joey Iupa, who was the boss of Chicago Outfit at the time, and several of his main guys, Jackie Cerrone and Angelo LaPietra, and oh God, there's a couple others up there, and all of a sudden their names have, oh, Joey Lombardo, who just died, actually. Joey Lombardo just died this last weekend. He's a last man standing, convicted Milton Rockman out of Cleveland, who had kind of taken over. They had an unusual circumstance. Angelo Leonardo out of Cleveland, they ended up turning him out of it, and he testified. So the guy down under him that was was going and picking up the skim money and taking it back for distribution, and convicted him, and then convicted the boss of Milwaukee, Frank Ballesteri, out of that. And so those wiretaps and that audio, I used a lot of those in the movie. So when I wrote my book, I really focused on those wiretaps and what they said. So what I did in the Kindle version, and where I'm coming back around here to using the digital media and hooking to the internet, I was able to digitalize all those wiretaps, all that audio. I put them up on a site on Vimeo with a private link, and then I did a Kindle version of my book, and I used a lot of the transcripts. I would explain what this transcript was saying, what they were talking about, and why it was important, and then I'd have the transcript in the book, and then you can click on the heading of the transcript in the Kindle version and go right to the audio and listen to the actual audio while you're reading the book. And then, you know, go to the next chapter and read what is this transcript going to mean, and why is it important, and where did it fit in the scheme of things, and click on the heading and go listen to it. So I'm just constantly trying to figure out how to interact with the digital media and make it more, you know, get more information out for people to, and, you know, accurate first, that's what we call primary source information. That was right out of the mouths of the men that did it there.
You know, it amazes me, you know, if you watch any documentary about the mob, and I loved Gangland Wire, by the way.
Well,
if you watch any documentary, it mostly goes into saying how, you know, one of these smaller guys gets popped for something, then they turn and become a government informant, and they take down a bigger fish and then a bigger fish. And then, you know, if that didn't happen, they started killing each other. And that just, they kind of just got rid of the issue by themselves there. But
yeah,
it really, it's really interesting to sit down and try to learn the inner workings of these guys, because there was so much sadisticness going on with the mafia that, you know, that's normal people
kind of sit back and are just dumbfounded and drop the jaw because the stuff that I've learned from watching this stuff is pretty amazing.
Really? Like, we were able to, I say we, the FBI, I worked on the case with them, but I was down on the streets running around following people for them. But they were able to put a hidden microphone in a lawyer's office, and the boss, Nick Civella, and his underboss, Tuffy DeLuna, would sit around in the lawyer's office when the lawyer wasn't there, of course, because they had to turn it off if the lawyer was in the room, but he was hardly ever there. And they just sit around and just talk about, you know, stuff and have opinions about it. Like, for example, Lefty Rosenthal, who a lot of people know was a Robert De Niro character in the movie Casino. Lefty Rosenthal was creating a big stir out in Las Vegas because the gaming control board was trying to boot him out of the casino, and he kept fighting them and
wow.
taking him to court and really creating a big stir out there. And Nick Civella hates it when anybody creates a big stir. He was getting a pretty big piece of that action between him and when Chicago and Kansas City were getting the main part of that action out of the Stardust, where Lefty was coordinating the scheme, and he was drawing a lot of attention to himself and to the Stardust. And he they got word from another source they had out there in Las Vegas that Lefty was going to try to blackmail the state's attorney, I can't even think of the name, it'd be like the prosecuting attorney, but for the state, who was bringing the charges against him in the front of the gaming commission, and he was going to try to blackmail him, and he was going to claim
wow.
that he had an affidavit from a prostitute who this guy had used at the inside the casino at the casino at the Stardust Hotel, and they're discussing it, and Tuffy's saying, well, Joe told me that, you know, he's got a Puntana, I think that what they called her, a prostitute who is going to sign an affidavit against List, was the guy's name was Bob List, the attorney general out there. That's what the attorney general is the word I was trying to think of. And Nick Civella says, oh, he said, he better not do that. He said, Tuffy says, I can't believe he'd be that, have that dumb a brain. And then Nick says, yeah, he said, that stuff went out with high button shoes, man. So it's so interesting to hear him discuss that. You know, they're much more sophisticated than doing something like that now. And it was fascinating insight into how they think, how they reason things out, worrying about whether people were stealing from the scheme and, questioning we got a tape of them questioning their moles out there in the Tropicana about how they know if somebody's stealing and exactly how they do it. This one guy, Carl Thomas, was their main guy that was skimming, and he'd say, yeah, he said, you just go back in the count room. He said, you call him peek him off. I think it means give him a little money. You give the security guard out front, peek him off a little bit, and he don't know what's going on the inside. And you go into the count room, and he says, it's boom, boom, boom. Just lay out 40 hundreds and walk out with them. Nobody ever knows it's before it's counted. I mean, that's on a tape. Talk about damning evidence for a trial against a mob boss for skimming from a Las Vegas casino. That was like, you just can't argue with that one.
Yeah, it all boiled down to talking too much. I mean, they thought they were safe in their own homes or in, you know, some secret place. But, you know, when they already got wiretaps in place, you know, it's not going to really matter if you're in your car, if you're in your home. There's so many places that stuff could be placed.
Yeah.
You're just not going to realize it, and you're blurting out all this information that's going to end up being used against you in a trial.
Yeah. And that audio on that one, that was in a house in the suburbs here in Kansas City. And luckily, they used the room where they bugged. Now, we had another big-time meeting. I think Alan Dorfman came down from Chicago. And these guys, they're smart. And in this particular meeting, they didn't use the main, like the what would be the den, where you'd think the men would go in and sit around the den. They actually got real smart, and they went in and used the bedroom to sit and talk. somebody was smart, because that it takes more probable cause to bug a bedroom. It's almost impossible to bug a bathroom than it does to bug like the living room, because people have higher expectations of privacy in the bathroom and the bedroom.
Right.
So those subtle little things like that. Now, they don't always do that, but once in a while they think ahead and take some extra precautions.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I mean, I guess you think about it, the bathroom is the place where you think you're going to have some sanctity.
So if you're going to have some dirty conversations, go in the bathroom.
Yeah, if there's one place you're going to spout your mouth, you might as well do it with a clean bowl. Or not so clean bowl, but there's a place to catch it.
Yeah, really.
Now, being that you were involved with for over two decades with the Kansas City Police and numerous other facets of that, what was the most interesting or craziest thing you saw in the whole time that you were doing these interesting kind of jobs?
Oh, most interesting. God, I don't know. I mean, that mob stuff was pretty interesting, but it could be kind of boring. You just sit and watch and wait and watch and write down license numbers and follow them around a little bit and see who they meet up with lunch. It gets a little bit boring. I'm trying to think of what they're – I mean, you don't know. It's not interesting until you get the bigger picture on down the road. You have to have a lot of patience to do that. I know one time we did an investigation on the Ku Klux Klan. It was pretty interesting. We had a local small clavern, they call it, four or five kind of just dead-end losers is all they were, guys with, you know, like minimum wage jobs practically, and even if they even had that. One of them was a plumber. He had a little wherewithal, but mainly they were just like 30-something loser guys, and then this one guy was kind of their leader, and he was the plumber. And then there's a couple of guys that used to live in Kansas City, and they worked for TWA. They were machinists or something, TWA, and they were twin brothers, the Mahan brothers, Dennis and, Todd, I think, Mahan. And they had moved to Oklahoma, and they really gotten big in the Klan they were kind of like Dennis was like the Grand Kleagle of the Midwestern clans. And we, during this time, we had it was brand new, the public TV station for cable TV. We'd just gotten citywide cable TV. That's kind of dates this thing. It's a little bit old, I guess, but it's just gotten citywide cable TV. And one of the rules was they had to provide a public channel for anybody, and all the studio and training for any local person and group that wanted to come in and do a program. So the Klan decided they were going to do a program on cable TV in Kansas City. And oh my God, people went crazy in this city, and they American Cablevision denied them, and then they filed a lawsuit. And of course, the Civil Liberties, the Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, I can't even get it right. I'll just say that. The acronym, the ACLU filed a lawsuit for them, and they won. You know, you cannot inhibit their freedom of speech. So they had to let them come in and do a program. And we got onto that, and ATF had a wire on them and some other, maybe down in Oklahoma. They were real cautious about what they told us. I only found out about the wire till later on. So they hipped us that these Mahan brothers were, Dennis in particular was coming up from Oklahoma, and he was going to bring some other guy that was a big leader in the skinheads and kind of on a national basis. They were coming up from Oklahoma, and they were going to bring some guys up from Oklahoma to periodically to help train. They had to take these training sessions, like one night a week for 2 hours for like a month, I think, that you go in and learn how to run the boards and run the camera, because the American Cablevision didn't have to provide any any talent to do this. They only provided the equipment. So they trained them, and so we sent guys in take, like they were taking the training right along with them, because there was people from other groups that were taking this training and learning how to run all these things. I'll never forget one of my undercovers came out after being in there, and she said, you know, she said, one of the guys is packing. I said, well, how do you know? She said, when he sat down on a bench, he clunked really loud. So he had a gun stuck up.
Just ignore that.
Okay. He had a gun stuck in his belt, and then he sat down real hard. Why it banged against the thing. We probably should have just grabbed him up right then. But we were kind of, this was kind of the lower level guys that were doing this training. And we were being told by the ATF that the Grand Kleagle was coming up for this thing, and he was going to be doing the talking when they did their program. And it was just a rant about white supremacy stuff. And they, so finally the night came when they were going to do it. And we got a couple of attack squads. That's about 10 guys and a couple of sergeants and their captain, and just got them in the area. And not unmarked, but police cars that looked like police cars. They have red lights and sirens, and these guys all wore their uniforms. And we were undercover and down all around the place in the van up close to see who was coming and going. And just looking around for them to see where they parked before they went in, because you couldn't just like park right in front. There wasn't a parking lot. We wanted to know where their cars were. So we start picking up on them, parking about 3 or 4 blocks away. And so a couple guys just sat on those cars, and we had a car in the van. We had the van down there and watched them come. And oh, it got wild. We started off with, we had a pickup truck that was part of them that just kept driving around and around the area like they were their security guard on the outside. And so finally we had the TAC guys, while they were in there doing their program, about the time it would have been over, we had the TAC guys just pull them over, and they got 2 or 3 guns out of that truck. And about that's just before that, there was one of their guys that got there late or something, because our two guys in the van, they saw this guy running down the street, down Main Street. It was on Main Street, running down the street. And there's a black guy standing there, and he like runs by him, and he yells the N-word at him, and get out of the way, and the N-word, and just keeps on going. So I got one guy in this van that's kind of, he's aggressive. He slips out of the van and cuts a guy off just before he gets to the thing and just takes him down, and the guy's got a gun on him. So,
oh no.
So got him for CCW, load him up in the police car. About that time, all these guys on the inside, there's about 6 of them on the inside, and they're trying to contact their outside security by walkie-talkie, those little CB radios, handheld CB radios, and they can't get them, so they panic. So they all come, all of a sudden they all come boiling down, running. So our van or surveillance jumps on the air and tells the TAC guys, hey, they're all out and they're all running north. we had one guy left sitting up at where a couple of their cars were parked, and he's sitting there, and one of them, you remember the guy I said that sat down and clunked? He came running up and opened his trunk and pulled a gun out of his belt and threw it in the trunk. So Terry jumps out and grabs him, and then so we pop him for carrying a concealed weapon and get his gun out of his trunk and tow his car. And Dennis Mahon and a couple, 3 others, they got their car was parked somewhere else, and they got it. So, but they don't leave town. They just keep driving around because they can't figure out what happened to all their guys or a lot of their guys. And what happened? So finally the TAC guys or one of my guys sees them and calls the TAC guys, and they pull them over and take them. We take everybody downtown. We got about 6, I got about 8 people, I think, all together, different places. A couple of them are really legitimately under arrest for CCW. The rest of them, we just hanging on to them. The captain, I get hold of the captain over the TAC kid. I said, well, captain, what do you think? Because I was a sergeant. He says, take them all downtown. So we take all these guys downtown, book them in. I'm in the jail. I don't even know what we booked them for. We really didn't have a charge against them. And put them in the jail, and then we'd bring them down. We brought all of them down and put them on the show up. And we had a stage for the lineups. and took pictures of them. We took all their guns and stuff that we'd recovered, a taser and two or three shotguns and a couple of handguns and some clubs, and laid them all out on the table and took pictures of them because we knew we wanted to tell the news about all this. So they liked those pictures of guns on the table. And then we'd bring them down one by one and just start interviewing them, just start asking them everything that we could think of about their organization and why they were there and what their connection was and who their other connections were. Of course, none of them really would talk to us, but so process, you know, just ran through them. We were there for about, I don't know, must have been there until 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning until we got down to the last one and kicked him out. We had the two we held overnight for the CCW, and we kicked everybody else out on the street, and their cars were in the tow lot. So I get up the next day. I wake up about noon or something, because I get into, I think, 6 in the morning, to get a call from the captain. He says, I said, Gary, you got to get in here. You got to go down and meet with the chief. And I'm thinking, oh, shit. So I meet him down at headquarters. We go in, and the chief Joyner, who was a good guy, and he's like, you know, he says, Sergeant, he says, I just want to thank you for what you all did last night. He said, that was great. Because by then we'd gotten hold of the day shift, or my daytime guy had gotten hold of the public affairs people and showed them all these pictures and told them all what we did. So then they released all that to the media. So then the paper the next day had this whole big splash about how we caught all these Klan guys after their, because it was a huge news event anyhow, the fact, because they'd had all that to do about whether they could do that or not. And so everybody was pretty happy with us. I made a friend. There's kind of trying to explain, I don't know if I can explain this guy, but he gets donations from various people and groups, and he keeps intelligence on right-wing, white supremacist types groups. That's all he does. He clips newspaper clippings. He's got people. He can pay people to go out and try to infiltrate these things, and it's all private. And so I made a hell of a friend out of him. Boy, from then on, if I wanted to know anything about that, I'd get hold of him and he'd tell me anything. Whereas before, he really wouldn't. He was pretty cautious. I knew him and kind of tried to develop him as a source, but he was pretty cautious because everything they do is not, I don't want to say, I don't know how to explain it, but it's like a total, it's a little intelligence operation that's off the books totally, and really hardly anybody knows about it. But it was a pretty that was one of the more interesting capers I did.
Well, it seems like that's where the big issues with these guys arise. You know, they just get guns, they start popping them off in the middle of the street and concealing them and bringing them into public, and
yeah,
there's your issue, and they're having these weapons charges. But yeah, we're about out of time. I'd hate for us to get disconnected.
Okay.
As far as the future goes, what can we expect from you? What do you have coming up?
Well, you know, I've got my movie Gangland Wires out there on Amazon, and so is my book and the Kindle version. I recommend you get that. I've got my true crime podcast once a week, Gangland Wire. We just deal with strictly mafia topics. And I've got this new movie coming out that's going to be out for my Mafia Film Festival November the 15th, and it'll be up on Amazon pretty quickly after that, or maybe a little bit before. It'll be called Brothers Against Brothers, the Savella-Spiro War. It's about a mob war in Kansas City in the 70s that was going on while all this this other dispute over the entertainment district called River Key was going on. We had a pretty lively lots of killing, lots of bombings in the 1970s in Kansas City, like every other city. It's like Danny Green. This story is a lot like the Danny Green story in Cleveland, where a young upstart criminal tries to make some inroads with the local mafia group, and they try to work like heck to wipe them out. And that's what happened in that one. So that's what I've got coming up.
Well, that sounds awesome, Gary. Best of luck with everything.
All right, thank you.
You're able to keep bringing this important, crucial history to the masses.
All right, I'll do
it. It's always nice talking with you, sir.
Nice talking with you.
Enjoy the rest of your night.
All right.
Be good.
All right, thank you. Good night.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All righty, guys. You couldn't just join us because we're not currently live anymore. But if you join late, I always give this spiel out. You can always go back in about 10 minutes, check out the archive. Big thanks to Gary Jenkins. We are going to be back October 23rd with author, adjunct faculty member at the U of I Springfield, State of Illinois criminal investigator, criminologist, and 2019 Dark History and Horror Con guest, Stephen G. Angelo. He's going to be making his return to the show. And, of course, Dark History and Horror Con is coming up this week, and I'm so excited. October 26th and 27th, 2019, at the City Center in Champaign, Illinois. Visit dhhcon.com or city, I believe it's city, let me check that real quick. I don't want to give you guys the wrong address for ordering tickets, because that would be good. I think maybe you can get them at dhhcon.com. But City Center has them for sale on their website, which I am trying to pull up right now. There's a lot of places called City Center. Go figure. CityCenterChampaign.com. You can order tickets there. And, of course, for guest information, vendors, podcast information, discussions, everything like that that's going on, check out their website. Big thanks again, Gary Jenkins. We will see you guys on Wednesday for Steve G. Angelo. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great night.